having looked at Yachloku, so we know that Yachloku is only one of many different methods that we have for determining who wins in property conflicts. And the one that it's most often compared to, even though as we saw there are about six total, but the one that it's most often compared to is Kolda Olivar. And Kolda Olivar is a difficult concept to pin down. The phrase translated directly really sounds like it means might takes right, or whoever is stronger is going to prevail. That's how it literally would translate. So what exactly does that mean? It is subject to a wide range of interpretation. On the one hand, you have the Rashbam and others who seem to basically understand that essentially what Kolda Olivar is Beis Din throwing up their hands. Is Beis Din saying, we can't deal with this, or we don't have to deal with this, and we don't have enough to make a meaningful contribution to the story. There's no evidence. There's no facts in front of us. We don't have established validin even, let's say. So therefore, it's not productive for Beis Din to be involved. So we're stepping away. That's what it sounds like the Rashbam is saying. There are those who view the Rashbam a little bit differently. But that's how the Rashbam is generally understood, that essentially it is a siluk. It's Beis Din withdrawing. And the Rush understood it very differently. You mentioned the Rush a little bit the other day. The Rush appears in a few places. It appears here in Bava Metzia, appears in Bava Basra as well, where the Rush maintains that Kolda Olivar is actually a good system. A Kolda Olivar is a way to get to the truth, because through this process we can rely on the assumption that the one who actually owns it legitimately will be motivated to fight harder, to press his case more aggressively, and therefore ultimately he's likely going to win. So we can assume under such circumstances that this is somewhat of a birur, this is somewhat of a verification of what the din actually is, because it will lead to a conclusion consistent with that. We mentioned the other day how maybe he's assuming some type of a loss aversion theory, that the person who actually has something to lose, because it's really his, is going to take it much more seriously than somebody who's just trying to steal something. Or also, maybe there are just limits to how dishonest people are going to be. But in any event, that's the Rush's working assumption. So his assessment, it sounds like, is basically an actual beer and not simply Beis Din staying at it. So one of the differences that comes out is the question of whether Kolda Olivar is basically a one-time deal, which is essentially what the Rush says. We have one shot at this contest. He has the language of Kol Misha Yigbar Yodo B'Pam HaRishona, that whoever's hand prevails the first time, the first round, we can assume he is the one who is actually correct. While other Rishonim say no, like the Shita Mekubetzes and others, that we're basically staying out of this, and therefore we'll stay out of each time. And if it goes back and forth, it goes back and forth. So this also helps to illustrate another point. We mentioned it the other day, I think Aaron raised this point, that we have one of the different factors that are involved in terms of distinguishing. When do we say Yechogu? When do we say Kolda Olivar? So the Gemara of Abbasra mentions a factor called Ikal Omekim Olodimilsa. Sometimes there is the possibility of establishing facts, and sometimes there's no possibility of establishing facts. So Ikal Omekim Olodimilsa, that you can have a hope of figuring out what the truth is. Is that a positive factor or a negative factor?
So you could see it both ways.
So for example, if one takes a Russian view here, and one says that this is all about figuring out the truth, so you're working off the fact that, yeah, ikla mekamala de milsa, that there is what that can come out. So therefore, let's do that. Let's push for all the evidence to be brought forward. And by the way, the Rush also says that that's one of the reasons why he thinks it's going to work, because the person who's lying could be afraid that the other guy has witnesses. The other guy is going to show up with some edim, and that's why he's also going to pull back a little bit. But that's all a part of his working theory, that ikla mekamala de milsa is a reason to do it kol ha'ikvar, because it will lead to the truth. While it's interesting, if you look to the Trumas HaDeshen, the Trumas HaDeshen and the Tshuva, he has a much more negative spin on kol ha'ikvar in general. And it's related to the ikla mekamala de milsa point of view. Now this matches very much a quote from Trumas HaDeshen we talked about yesterday or 2 days ago in a different tshuva, but it's all the same philosophy. You may recall that we had a discussion, is Yachloku the ideal? Or is Kol Dovigvar the ideal? And we connected it to the idea that Yachloku perhaps represents some type of pshara, and maybe Bezdin is geared towards pshara, ideally, if we can. While Kol Dovigvar maybe is geared more towards reaching emes, even if it's as kind of violent a process as possible, but it will get to the truth. Maybe that makes that preferable. I remember if we mentioned during Chazar, and I mentioned the first time around, that Rav Lichtenstein had said that when you have kol ha'ikvar, so 50% of the time, you're 100% right. And you have yachloku, 100% of the time, you're 50% right. And essentially, so what's our preferred scenario? That we will go for the MS and get the 100% truth at least half the time? Or is it that we'll get half the truth, but we'll get that all the time? So you may recall the other day, he said that the Trumas HaDeshen doesn't really like kol ha'ikvar. And he says that when it comes to yachloku, the ochsin factor is not a real chazaka. It's not treated like an actual chazaka. It's just good enough that it saves us from kol ha'ikvar. The kol ha'ikvar is kind of like Dina de Parsoi, he says, like the Persian justice, which makes no sense. We don't really like it so much. So as long as we have a little bit of a reason to say yachloku, we prefer that. You may recall that from the other day. So in a different tshuva, the Trumas HaDeshen says along the same lines, he says that when it comes to kol ha'ikvar, why do we do kol ha'ikvar? Because it's ikla lamekamala de milsa. There is a possibility of more facts coming out. And if Bezdin were to paskin, let's say, should the daini, which we'll talk about later, or yachloku, and it'll be contradicted by facts that come out, so then we run the risk of having divrei Bezdin shvurim, having the words of the Bezdin broken and embarrassed and disgraced. So in other words, first of all, it's another indication that he sees kol ha'ikvar as kind of a last resort, as kind of a negative. But also his point being that we're only doing it because facts could come out and that would potentially contradict what Bezdin would do. So in other words, yes, kol ha'ikvar is connected to ikla lamekamala de milsa, but in a negative way. So in the Russia's world, it's a positive thing. The truth could come out, so let's use this path to pursue the truth. In the Trumas HaDeshen's world, it's a negative thing. facts could come out. So any other method might end up contradicted by the facts. So we're stuck with Kol Da'al Mubar. So two opposite perspectives on Kol Da'al Mubar, which revolve around also this issue of how do you see this element of Ikal Meikum Alad Milsa, which can be viewed either positively or negatively. There are a lot of other issues that emanate from this question. There is also a machlokas rishonim, whether a bezdin will allow tfisa in the case of Kol Da'al Mubar. Let's say if somebody wins through Kol Da'al Mubar and the other person grabs it from him, tfisa, will bezdin interfere now? So the Shulchan Aruch, and presumably the Rama agrees, says we don't allow tfisa in that case, which many understand the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch to be saying that they're following a Rashian view, that essentially this is a process of din, and therefore once that din has happened, so we're not going to let one guy steal it from the other, essentially. While Tosfos, Tosfos and Davav and Bav Metzia, does allow tfisa after Kol Da'al Mubar, apparently because they see, like the Rashbam, that this is not really a case where Beis Din has issued a psak. There hasn't been really a Maisa Beis Din here. And therefore, we're not going to engage in protecting the Kol Da'al Mubar winner.
Hi. Is it
Tosfos? This is on Davav. Hi.
That was Tosfos versus who?
Well, versus, let's say, other Rishonim, but we mentioned the Shulchan Aruch, and the Rama, we assume, agrees with the Shulchan Aruch. So, there are a couple of other issues that come out of this. One important issue is, so if Beis Din is involved versus not being involved, could affect the question of, I remember Ephraim asking this at the time, is the item in question really yours? Basically, do we recognize it being your genuine property because Beis Din has awarded it to you? Or do we say, no, we don't have any actual awareness that it's yours. It's just in your hands right now, and we won't stop it from being in your hands. But that could change at any moment. It doesn't really reflect any halachic reality. So, for example, a lulav and esrog, which require a din of lachem, perhaps we won't say that it's actually lachem. Okay, you're allowed to use it, it's in your hands, but for the halacha to actually recognize you as the formal owner, maybe we're not going to do that. We suggested you could make up a sukkah story, like one of the stories you learn about in elementary school about adventures and esrog mining and piton breaking and all those stories. So you could make up a story about some beautiful, huge esrog which two people got into a fight over. And then the Beis Din said, all right, say Kol Da'al Mubar. And one guy prevailed over the other, and he was so happy because he won and he got the precious esrog. And then the rabbi told him, but you can't actually use it on sukkahs because it doesn't have a din lachem, because Kol Da'al Mubar is not considered actually yours. That'd be a great twist at the end of the story. No, we just made it up. But, sorry? Yeah, got his comeuppance. That here he's so proud of himself that he beat out the other guy, and you see from there that it's not kedai to fight like that. It's not the way to be. So that's an important question. Is it really yours, or is it essentially just in your possession, but we don't actually recognize it as yours? This is something that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman discusses in the Kovei Shiurim and the Bava Basra, and presumably also emerges from this whole range of opinions in terms of the Rush and the Rashba. Seems to flow from there. Hi.
That psak would only be according to Tosfos, though, right?
Which psak?
That in that case of the Esro, you wouldn't like allow him to use it because of Blachar. That after the Rush, seemingly the Rush would say.
And the Rashbam also, probably.
Right.
Yeah, that whole camp.
Saying that whole thing was only with
the Tosfos. Right. It sounds like you probably say that if you believe Beis Din is throwing up their hands and being masalic, and you allow tfisa, right? It would seem to correlate to that whole for that whole story. Again, feel free as a project to make up a nice such a story. I guess it's a little late for that. There are some who think that matzah also needs lachem, so you can make up a story like that for Pesach. Okay. Lachem is really a din that we know by Ulav and Esrog, and then by all kinds of other mitzvos you find Rishonim and Achronim asking, maybe this needs lachem, maybe that needs lachem, maybe Neres Chanukah needs lachem, so you can make up a story for Chanukah also about some beautiful menorah people were fighting over, and I'm sure you could come up with something good. In any event, so another major issue that is discussed is what should the story be when it comes to Machlokas HaPoskim? What if the issue between two people are fighting over something? Now the whole crux of their fight, it's not that one says, I bought it, the other guy says, I bought it. It's not that there's a factual dispute or any type of a historical issue. Let's say all the facts are agreed upon, but the reason they're disagreeing is because of a machlokas haposkim. Would you say kol d'olam gvar in such a scenario? So what do you think? Should you say kol d'olam gvar in the case of machlokas haposkim? So it's an interesting discussion because there are reasons not to say it. But those reasons also work off different directions because the Ramah says that you should say kol d'olam gvar if there is a machlokas haposkim. And many of the later Svarim and the Nos Kelim LeShulchan Aruch, they ask against this Ramah. Why? Because they think it contradicts the Rush. Why does it contradict the Rush? I want to try to explain.
The thing we're worried about is
Well, I think I knew what you're going to get at. That's actually different than the Rush part. We'll come back to that point in a second. John, you want
to... According to the Rush, the whole idea that you're dealing with the Pesach based in, since both of them went to their individual bunim, they're not interested in what the middle based in is. They had their own personal sort of based in.
Well, that's interesting. That's actually a third reason. I haven't told you yet what the first two are. So the reason it's perceived as a contradiction to the Rush is because the Rush is assuming the person who knows the truth is with him is going to be motivated to fight harder. So that's because he knows that he's the factual owner. But if it all hinges on a machlokas haposkim, that's really beyond these litigants. They're not motivated by the fire of halachic truth. Of lomdus, and halavai, it should be the case. Mechamta shel Torah is what's giving them their passion. But it's the passion, the Rush's whole svar is that they know that they're the guy who actually owned it to begin with. But not that he knows that the poskim, the svar of the Tosfos against the Raibid is in his favor. So many question the Rush, why should it work when it's a machlokas ha-poskim that's involved? So it's a fair question. But it's also interesting that the Trumas HaDeshen, who we said is the opposite end of the Rush, Trumas HaDeshen doesn't like kol d'olam gvar, would also lead you to the conclusion that you should not use it for machlokas haposkim. Because, and it's again just really fascinating to point out how you can really come to the same conclusion from different directions, and really from opposite directions. So the Trumas HaDeshen's basic point was, what did we say a few minutes ago? That we're worried that the truth will come out because the facts will emerge. And if we do anything other than kol d'olam gvar, maybe it'll get contradicted. So if the only issue is a machlokas haposkim and there isn't any other factual matters that can come forward, so then we don't have that concern. If the issue is some kind of factual history, so maybe there'll be aid them, there'll be documents, something will turn up. But if the issue is machlokas haposkim, so we're worried about what? About a bas kol coming down and say the halacha is like the tshuva of Rabbi Akiva? So we don't have to worry about that in that case. So you could object to it from either direction. But it's two different ways of coming to that same conclusion, which again is a somewhat interesting point. Now you still have to figure out, we'll come back to this in a minute, so how does the Ramah say what he says then? But the truth is, the Ramah has a Gemara. It's a Gemara in Gittin, where the Gemara does sound like it's applying Kol Olam Kvar to a Machlokas HaPoskim. The Gemara talks about Amas HaMayim, about the question of water rights between somebody who lives above and somebody who lives below the water, and it's Machlokas HaPoskim, how you decide. And the Gemara sounds like essentially it's a Kol Olam Kvar approach. So the Shema Sadeshin discusses that, and the Taz talks about this on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch. And it's a question in of itself, even without the Ramah. And the assumption seems to be, or the only approach that they offer, is that maybe it's a specific Takanas Chachamim in that case. That Chazal said that that's the best way to deal with that specific suffix. But as far as the Lumdus, it seems to be a question that if you say, all right, we'll stay out of it, okay. But if you say like the Rush or like the Shema Sadeshin, so then there's a reason not to invoke this in the context of a Machlokas HaPoskim. There is another interesting question one could ask. And I think this is like a dumb question one could raise. When we say Kol Olam Kvar, are there any limits to what's fair? Right? Do we say all's fair in love and gvar? Is there essentially limitless approaches you can use? Or do you say that, no, there are certain rules, there are certain restrictions? Now, first of all, okay, we'll assume that anything that's an outright halachic violation, so that's off limits. But even without that, is there anything that simply is not consistent with what we're good, with what we're going for? So, for example, if you follow the Rush, I would just think misvara that there are probably some things that are too far. First of all, I would wonder what would the Rush say if you're dealing with two litigants and one who happens to be, you know, three times the size of the other guy. If there is a huge disparity in power between the two parties, so would that mitigate his assumption that one is going to be so motivated by the truth that he's going to overcome? If he's up against a Goliath, maybe it's not Shaykh. So that's just a question one could ask based on the Rush's Svara. Is it possible that the system wouldn't let you invoke Stam anything in order to make this point of Kol Olam Kvar? So I don't know about that question specifically in terms of being addressed in the literature, but it's similar to a question which is addressed, and that's the question of our kos. Can somebody use the secular courts for the purpose of Kol Olam Kvar? Is that a tool that's at your disposal in order to gain the upper hand in control of this item? So here, there is a fascinating display of halachic development, because there are, let's say, three sources that say that you should not use the secular courts for this purpose, but they're for different reasons, even though they're all building on each other. And those different reasons are relevant. They're interesting points. Three different points. So we'll work backwards chronologically. The Ramah, elsewhere, the Ramah in Siman Dalet, Choshen Mishpat, talks about the concept of Avid Inish Dinu L'Nafshe, that there are times when if it's impossible for Beis Din to help you enforce justice, that there are times when it's permissible to take action into your own hands. So does that mean you could also use the secular court system to do so? So the Ramah says no. And Rav Moshe Feinstein disagrees. Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva writes against this Ramah. And he says he thinks the Ramah is making a simple mistake. He says the Ramah is confusing this, essentially, with Kol Olam Kvar. He says when it comes to Kol Olam Kvar, then you should not be able to use the court system. Why? Because of the Rush. If the whole idea is that you're going to be moved by your passion for the truth to fight harder, So then, using the court system, that's not fair. That's external weaponry. That's not going to gain any power from the fact that you feel more passionate about your position. So says Rav Moshe, yeah, so for Kol Dolam Gvar, it doesn't make sense to use the court system. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't use it for anything. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't use it for Avnish Dinol Nafshei, and therefore he disagrees with the Rush. But if you look, the Rush is based on a Trumas Hadeshen. Yet again. So if you look in the Trumas Hadeshen, the Trumas Hadeshen does talk about why it is that you shouldn't use a secular court for Kol Dolam Gvar. He writes there that that is essentially within the prohibition of using secular courts, arkos. And there he quotes the Mordechai. But the way the Trumas Hadeshen writes, what's the issue? The issue is it's mechur. How do you translate mechur? Unseemly, inappropriate. So that's really a different reason. And that theoretically could apply to Avodin Ishtidl and Nafsha. Now, if you look back before him, if you look at the Mordechai, so he references a Mordechai in the end of Bava Kamma. I think the one he's referring to is based on a Gemara and Daf Kuf Yud Zayin in Bava Kamma. Where there, the Mordechai talks about really what would be a third reason. There, the Gemara has a case. The Gemara doesn't use the term Kol Dolam Gvar there, but it seems to be a case of Kol Dolam Gvar, where the Gemara talks about two people who are fighting over a net. And one of them got the secular authorities involved, and he was criticized for it. So the Mordechai says, why is he criticized? Why was he rebuked? So it's not because it's Mesira. That's not the relevant issue. But the issue is that since it's Kol Dolam Gvar, so Kol Dolam Gvar is going to require the ability of Beis Din to oversee the property being transferred from one hand to the next. But that's what's indicated. And if you get the secular authorities involved, so they're going to hold on to it. And you're not going to be able to move it back and forth. So therefore, it undermines the whole mechanism of Kol Dolam Gvar. So essentially, it gives us three different reasons to say that Kol Dolam Gvar should not use the arkos, should not use the secular courts. Now working forward historically, so first the Mordechai, because it doesn't allow us the flexibility of moving back and forth once the courts get involved, or the Trumas Hadeshen, because it's unseemly, it's mechur, or Rav Moshe, based on the Rush, that it's not going to reflect anyone's passion for truth, it's essentially not playing fair, and that perhaps addresses the question that we had, are there some things that are out of bounds in terms of what Kol Dolam Gvar can allow, just for it to make sense in terms of what it's supposed to operate based on the way the Rush explained.
I'm still talking about snitching things in the government.
Yes, in general. So sometimes the question is the serious.
Why
would it be the problem? So the Mordechai says over there that it's not the problem because in general you're usually allowed to in order to save your own things. So if somebody is stealing things from you or somebody has your stuff and there's no other way to get it, so then usually that should be looked at. That's part of the whole discussion. So what the Mordechai is saying is that seems to not be the issue here. It seems to be that it's because it undermines the Kol Dolam Gvar that should have been
there.
It
seems like a lot of the government
kept it. That's what it sounds like. It sounds like that they essentially took over the process, and that's what Mordechai is objecting to. So in terms of the Avinash Dolan Afshay point, so Rav Moshe's point that you should distinguish, so it depends. According to the Mordechai and the Rush, maybe you should distinguish between the two, but according to the Trumas Hadeshen that the Ramah is based on, maybe he's right to compare the two. Say it's both Mechur, it's unseemly, so it's unseemly in both cases. Now, part of the reason the Nosei Kelim and others object to the Ramah, first of all, because he's against the Rush. Sounds like he's against the Rush. When the Ramah said that a Sveika Dedina, you could do Kol Da'alam Gvar. Because a Sveika Dedina is not going to, again, benefit from the passion. But why can't I say that the Ramah disagrees with the Rush? So it's possible, but we also noted before that the Ramah seemed to be of the view that we won't allow Tfisa after Kol Da'alam Gvar. Which sounds like he's saying he thinks it's an absolute psak, which seems to be consistent with the Rush. So is there a way to satisfy both views that the Ramah is saying you can't have tfisa afterwards, it's an actual psak, like the Rush, but it applies by a sveika dedina, which would not seem to be consistent with the Rush. So Rav Zsolti discussed this in his Mishnas Yavetz, and Rav Zsolti wanted to suggest that perhaps there are two dinim in Kol Da'alam Gvar. Just like we saw there are two dinim in Yachloku, at least, maybe there are two dinim in Kol Da'alam Gvar also. And maybe sometimes it's an actual beer, such as when it's based on a factual dispute. And it's in that context that we'll say we won't allow tfisa. And sometimes we'll say that it's Beis Din throwing up their hands. And that's what we'll say if it's a sveika dedina. Rizalti in that piece also goes on to say that he thinks that the Rambam seems to see things like the Rashbam, but it's essentially a siluk. Because the Rambam has the following psak. The Rambam says, let's say you have two people fighting over a boat, something like that. That's the case of Kol Da'alam Gvar that the Gemara has. So he says, essentially, that's the rule, Kol Da'alam Gvar. Unless the two parties say, listen, who wants to do things this way? We don't want to fight things out in such a manner. So let's split it. Yachloku. Okay, that would be a logical approach to take. But says the Rambam, Yachloku b'shvua. So what does Yor Sameach ask about that? What seems striking about that Rambam?
If I say it was not because it can't have
b'shvua. Yeah, that's actually the fancier question.
Okay.
But even just without getting into the Stechuzah, it's a good point as well. But
why
is Shua? Why is Shua? If the two parties agree to split something, you know, if two of us found a pizza on the table, and we're sorry? Right, so if you see two people decide that they agree with each other, then they could split it. So then why should we need a Yachlok? I'm watching a Shua, rather. So let's say a normal Kol Da'alam Gvar case. So the din is normally Kol Da'alam Gvar. But the Rambam says that if they agree, they would rather split it than fight it out, so they can split it with a shul. So why should I need a shul if they agree? So Rav Zsolti suggests, according to the Rambam, that Kol Da'alam Gvar is essentially a siluk, is Beis Din not being involved. And if you want to have Yachloku, you're asking Beis Din to be involved. And if Beis Din is going to get involved, they have to follow their procedure, which means with a shul. Even though, on the surface, logically speaking, you could argue that it doesn't really need a shul. Yes, sir?
I mean, even though the Mishnah really states that there's not shemotiv.
In terms of Shnei Motiv and Batalis.
Right. Clearly involves an involvement in Beis Din.
Yes, but it's also part of the details of how they operate. But here, once you're going to take this Kol Da'alam Gvar case and make it into a Yachloku case. Right, essentially. So, let's just say a few words about the Shudu D'Daini, which is probably third on the list of top methods for assessing things. So what does Shudu D'Daini mean? That's itself a major question. So most of the Rishonim, Rashi, the Rashbam, the Rambam, say, what does Shudr Dedayinim mean? It means that Beis Din will assess who wins. So let's say you have Shtei Shtaros HaYotzim B'Yamechad, you have two contracts, two documents that have the same date on them, and they contradict each other. You have to figure out who really wins, who really has the upper hand. So what should the Beis Din do? So they should try to assess who it seems to them is more logically the winner, more likely the winner, and act accordingly. Tosfos, however, has a different take on it. What does Tosfos say it means?
Dayan have no responsibility to try and figure out actual truth. It's just discretionary.
Right. Total judicial discretion. They can give it to whoever they want. They don't have to base it on anything. So Tosfos asks the question. Tosfos in Bava Basra asks the question. Tosfos' Shita is in Bava Basra and Daf Lamed Hey. It's also in Kedushin Daf Ayin Dalet Amud Aleph. And you need both of them because they're interesting Shitas and interesting details in both Tosfos. So Tosfos in Bava Basra asks the son himself that, all right, so you'll say the Dayanim could do whatever they want. So then maybe somebody will bribe the Dayanim. If there's no criteria for what makes the decision, so then what's to stop somebody from paying off one of the dayanim? So you could say maybe an afanami. And it's interesting that Yerushalmi in Yisubis actually has a slightly different phrase for shuchta the dayanim. What do they call it?
Shuchta
the dayanim. Sounds like it means bribing of the dayanim, and there's a machlokus between the Pnei Moshe and the Korban Ha'eda. Does that actually mean you could even go that far? Or is that somewhat of a sarcastic name that, of course, you can't go that far? So Tosfos takes it as a given that that would not seem to make sense, that we can't actually allow bribing of one of the dayanim. So Tosfos says, how do we guarantee that that's not going to happen? Because, as Tosfos says, still says, Shuda didayinim, they still have to be judges, and Hanotel Schar Ladun, if somebody gets paid to be a judge, so he's not considered to be a dayan, so clearly that undermines the whole system. Now, parenthetically, what we mean by that is, I mean, he's paid by one litigant separately from the other. Nowadays, in a contemporary Beis Din system, so the dayanim do get paid usually, but they have to get paid equally by both sides. They get paid for their time, schar batala, the whole discussion how exactly that works. But you can't have one litigant paying, that's essentially a bribe. So that's what Tosfos says. If that's the way it's going to work, then it's not called Dayanim. Now the other Rishonim, or also Tosfos as well, but differently than the Yerushalmi, if you don't translate Shuda as Shuchta, so Pashtus is Shuda means to throw. This is thrown in front of the Dayanim to decide as they will. There is a Gemara in Subis and Daf Pehe in Midbeis. The Gemara talks about two people named Tuvia, which sounds a little bit like Rashi's interpretation and the Rashbam like everyone else besides Tosfos. But you could read it both ways, because the Gemara says that there was somebody who wrote he's giving all his property to Tuvia, and lo and behold, turns out after he died that there were two Tuvias around. So we're not actually sure which Tuvia he meant to give it to. So the Gemara discusses a whole back and forth of how it could be evaluated. Well, which Tuvia was he closer to? Is he related to one of them? Is one Tuvia Talmud Chacham and one isn't? What possible reasons could there be to think that he would prefer one Tuvia over the other? This is in Ksubas and Daf Pehe in the Beit. So it sounds like Rashi. But essentially, there is a process of trying to figure it out. You don't just say whichever one you want, but you try to make some type of an effort to figure out which one makes more sense. So if that was all the Gemara said, it would sound a little bit like that. But the problem is, the Gemara mentions there Shuddu B'Daini, but it sounds a little bit from the Gemara that that's after they ran out of all other options, that they tried to consider all these questions. Was he closer? Was one related? Was one a Talmud Chacham? And then, if they can't find out any answers, so then they'll say, okay, so Shuddu B'Daini. So you could read it Tosfos' way also, that without having anything else to go on, so then they essentially say, we'll pick whichever one we want. So the Gemara could be read a little bit consistent with both interpretations. Tosfos also assumes that the, this is more Tosfos and Kedusha, and I Dalam and Aleph, that this process is based on Hefker, Bezdin, and Hefker. Which means, presumably, that this is Bullshitasam, that if you believe they're really figuring out who it should belong to and they're making a psak based on that, so then you don't have to come on to Hefker, Bezdin, Hefker. This is essentially their Bezdin authority to adjudicate a conflict. But if you're going to say they're going to give it to whoever they want to give it to, despite the fact that there's nothing in front of us that says that this person is more likely to be the right candidate. So it seems that that happens because the judge has decided to do it, to give it to this person. So maybe you need to rely on a mechanism like Hefker, Bezdin, Hefker in order for that to work. And Tosfos, Shitasam apparently, says that you require a Bezdin Kavua, an actual Bezdin, standing Bezdin, in order to invoke Shuddu B'Daini. A couple of other points that may flow from this, Tosfos and Bava Basra also quotes Rabbeinu Chananel. It says that we will only use Shuddu B'Daini in a situation of karka. If they're fighting over land, then maybe we'll use Shuddu B'Daini. Otherwise, we won't. What's that based on? Right?
That's in terms of buying land? Or?
In terms, let's say people are fighting over land. So let's say, for example, the Gemara talks about two shtaros that contradict each other. Right? The shtar represents who owns the land, who bought it. So why would we limit it to land? It's not really clear. We mentioned that the Sefer Betzor HaChayim, available on HebrewBooks.org, suggests that maybe the concern is, we're worried a little bit, that something's going to come out that's going to show this was a mistake, and we want to be able to reverse it if necessary. So land is always going to be in the same place. Theoretically, you have the ability to come and to fix it. The guy can't run off to some other country with his land. Now, you may ask, but wait a minute, if we said that we tend to apply Shuddu B'Daini in a situation where it's lekel amekum ala demilsa by its very nature. So it means that we're not expecting that to happen. So he points out there through various proofs that these things are never absolute. When we say lekel amekum ala demilsa, we're not prophets that we can know that there's no chance of anything coming out. It means there's a reasonable assessment that it's unlikely there's going to be any more information. So that's when we'll normally do Shuddu B'Daini. But there's still a possibility that something could come out. So to hedge against that, so if we're limited to land, so then at least we'll be able to fix it, we'll be able to address it, and come back and set things straight if necessary. And here as well, there is a discussion whether or not one can say Lachem by Shuddu B'Daini. It's a discussion in the Birkas Avram and others. Do we say that this is actual din, where we grant the property in every sense of the word to whoever wins? Which also seems to flow out of this question. And in general, there is a discussion, how strong is this Umdana? Rabbi Akiva Eiger suggests in one place that if you have nothing to go on, and you have an Eid Echad who comes and gives you some evidence says even if the Eid Echad is a Karov, he's first of all an Eid Echad, and he's related to one party, but it gives you some basis to think one way, so then the person who is supported by that one aid should win because of Shudin Dedayin. So it sounds like he's understanding the way Rashi and the Rashbam do, that essentially is based on the judges trying to figure out the most likely case. So since this witness makes things a little more likely, even though it's not really within the threshold of evidence normally, but if this is a Shudin Dedayin susceptible situation, so this counts from that perspective.
Is he limiting that to Mamonos cases or all cases?
Well, what would be an example for a non-Mamonos case?
I'm thinking like if you have an aguna or something.
Yeah, it wouldn't work for that. I mean, you have for personal status, you have normally a Dabra Shabarba Pachos Mishkain.
Right, so I'm saying it doesn't, he's not saying that you can.
You generally can't invoke something like this in that context. That is on a set of rules. But right, would have to be an interpersonal monetary kind of case. Okay, I think those were some of the major details that we discussed about these, let's say, three milestones. Hi.
Sorry. How did the Shiva Rush do it exactly?
Oh, the Rush also, I think, the Rush also had mentioned that he has a tshuva where he points out that these mechanisms are there. It's because we don't want people to fight forever. And we need to have shalom, so therefore the rabbinate is empowered to do things to make shalom.
So it doesn't necessarily line up with either Tosfos or everybody else.
Well, yeah, not necessarily, but okay. It is interesting, because thank you for bringing it up, because it's an important point. The more you live, the more you realize this is true. Remember at the time we discussed this Tshuva Sarash, so somebody here asked that maybe you could hear that if you're following the Rishonim other than Tosfos, that there is somewhat of a system going on here, somewhat of a real assessment of the truth. Okay, so it's below the normal threshold, but we're saying that we need to find a way to adjudicate things, so we give whatever we have, and that'll bring peace to the world. But someone asked, I forget who, that if you're going to take Tosfos' view, and say that it's essentially completely arbitrary, if the judge can say something based on nothing, how will that contribute to peace in the world? And I think it's an important psychological point that the contribution to peace comes from the fact that the machlokas is being taken off the table and that it's just not there to fight about. And you would be quite shocked, perhaps, to see the way people operate, that if I say, you have two people who are fighting over something, right? And neither of them have objective halachic evidence. They don't have eidim. They don't have contracts. Each one has a svara why they think they should win. Okay, you know, let's say the tuvya case. Let's say the two tuvyas were coming. I should get it because I was his favorite neighbor and I always mowed his lawn for him when he was away. And the other guy would say, I should get it because I was his partner at work, and work is the most important thing. So each one has a svara why they should win. If you want to make peace between people, sometimes if you endorse their logic as to why they should win, that itself becomes a huge point of contention. Well, if you're essentially just flipping a coin, it's just arbitrary and it's over, so then there's literally nothing to fight about. And sometimes if you want to really extinguish the machlokas, you have to be completely arbitrary. Because if you're anything less than arbitrary, and you're saying that I agree with your svara, even though we know neither svara is enough from a basic halachic threshold, so I say your svara is worth a little bit more than his, that itself can be the cause of endless machlokas, an endless questioning of Bezdin. Oh, you like my svara so much, you like his svara so much, my svara is better, let me tell you why. Sometimes the only way to really end a fight is for it to be completely arbitrary and unquestionable. And say, that's it. I like him better. That's the whole story. Not really, but he's wearing a blue shirt. It's my favorite color. That's it. And that's flipped a coin. That's all it takes to really take the issue off the table. You know, which is where we find in many areas of halacha, it's also very striking, there are many takanos that are made b'pnei hashalom, and very often what it means is that we're removing reasons for people to argue. So if you just take an argument out of the sphere of debate, so that itself is effective for shalom. So for example, you give a person the first aliyah, so once upon a time it could have been that Talmud Chacham could get the first aliyah. But that's subjective, so people will fight over who's a bigger Talmud Chacham. But if we say the Kohen always gets the first aliyah, so Kohen is not going to be subject to fighting, hopefully. So if you take a more objective standard, that's what it is. We don't leave room for anybody to say, well, I think my svara would have been this, I think my svara would have been that. And perhaps that's what the Rush is getting at when he says that Shuddha Dadaini is an example of a mechanism that exists, because sometimes we just have to have these tools in order to make shalom. Okay, any further questions about any of that? Okay, so those were the major principles. Yehemunach, etc. There wasn't so much more to say other than the things that we spoke about. Motzei Mechaver L'Horai is really its own separate sugya. So in terms of the different methodologies, it was really those three that we gave significant attention to. And so that was essentially the main points of what we said about them. So what we have left for our chazar is we got to talk about Dror de Mamona and about Migo. So I don't know if we can do that all on Monday. We'll see. Maybe it'll be Monday and Tuesday. And then probably what we'll do is, I guess, we'll allow one day, we won't have shir that day, we'll have all bechinas all day, we'll make appointments, and we'll meet with chavrusas, and we'll talk a little bit about the sugyas. So again, in terms of tomorrow, hopefully we're on for some type of a trip, possibly to Seagate, possibly to Oceanside, I have to find out. So please check your email, Jonathan will send out the...